It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news, it's Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, who's a little bit late, but we're reliably informed she'll be here in about 10 minutes' time. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we go in depth to look at what the Conservative Home Secretary Theresa May didn't mention in her conference speech, but which is a topic of discussion in many of the pubs still left open around the country. Just like the Leveson inquiry into phone hacking run by Lord Leveson, who is a personal friend of the Murdoch family, will that tactic wash though for child sexual abuse in Westminster and Whitehall and those inquiries? Her appointment of no less than three individuals to head these child sexual abuse inquiries, that's Lady Butler Sloss, Peter Wanless and now Fiona Wolfe, who have connections to suspects at the very same civil service which is under investigation. It beggars belief. We ask, is organised child abuse by people in the public eye another unwelcome import from the US? Also, the news that the European Union has approved all the special subsidies for the new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point near Bridgewater. Friends of the Earth's David Powell explains whether the deal is now really cut and dried. And Hong Kong, similar street protests happened back in 2010, and London-based filmmaker Sam Weill was working in the former colony at the time. He made a film called Out of the Shadows, where local people told the story of Hong Kong's strange halfway house between dictatorship and democracy. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 again. Showers easing off by Saturday afternoon to give more sunny spells. Sunny on Sunday with some showers. Next week, it's highs of 16 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers this week with some gusty winds. And next weekend, 11th and 12th of October, highs down 13. It's going down slowly, isn't it? And sunny spells next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news in a minute, hopefully in here, will be the Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, who's had a lengthy surgery today, apparently. She's just turned up, apparently. But we'll start off with the old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers looking at some of the news from this week's incredible Conservative Party conference. Now, first of all, the Osborne ultimatum, Martin. The Chancellor's benefits freeze bombshell will affect 10 million households. A two-year benefit freeze in working age benefits will save £3 billion. But critics, including Lib Dems, question whether this is the fairest way to fix the deficit.
Well, it clearly isn't the fairest way to fix the deficit, is it? And at the same time, the next day, the Prime Minister promised tax cuts for probably the top 15% of the population. And this, of course, presumes that the deficit comes down and the economy keeps rolling forwards as it's supposed to do. But of course, if it doesn't, then all of these calculations will go out of the window anyway. But, I mean, I think it's a fairly clear statement of political intent by the Conservative Party. They quite literally want to run Robin Hood in reverse. They're going to reduce the deficit on the backs of the poorest, and when it has been reduced, if it's reduced, they're going to give the benefit to the richest people in the society, which is who they represent.
Kerry McCarthy, you're the Labour MP for Bristol East. What are your thoughts about this ultimatum? Because the benefits freeze, is surely there's a point to it, and that is to make sure that the benefits bill doesn't grow any further. It's growing like Topsy, particularly housing benefit, and this is a way of just, you know, basically putting a cap on it.
Well, it's dealing with the symptoms, isn't it, rather than the causes. I mean, one of the reasons why housing benefits is running out of control is because of the pressure on house prices, the pressure on housing, the fact that there haven't been enough houses built, and the fact that we don't have the sort of rent controls that we need to make sure that there's affordable housing for people. And Labour's looking at things like abolishing letting agents' fees to try to bring the cost of that housing down. That's the reason why housing benefits have gone out of control, and I don't think the answer to it is just to freeze the benefits bill.
But don't you think the market should settle the price? I mean, there's a bunch of houses there, people own them, many of them are buy-to-let homes, and that actually, eventually, what should happen is a price should settle, which is a fair price between the person that needs the house and the person that owns it.
Well, that would be fine if supply and demand were equal, if there were houses available, but we know that so much, like more than 50%, I think, of the council housing stock was sold off under right to buy, and the government didn't allow councils to spend the proceeds on building more houses. So we have a real shortage of social housing. I think the waiting list in Bristol, I see figures like 17,000, 19,000 people trying to move into social housing. A lot of the people in private sector rented accommodation are living in very, very poor conditions as well. Problems with damp, you know, lack of maintenance, overcrowding. So there is a huge housing problem. Labour has said that by 2020 we'll be building 200,000 houses a year. That is obviously what is needed. Only when there are enough houses to go round can you say, well, it's up to the market to set a price for that. At the moment, the price is being set by the fact that there's this huge scarcity.
Well, Andreas Whittam-Smith wrote something, a fascinating article, I thought, on Wednesday in the Independent. The Conservative Party would have us believe that the poor deserve to be punished. When George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, got to his feet at the Tory conference on Monday to announce a further reduction in welfare payments, this was the situation facing the nation's poor. About 5.5 million adults go without essential clothing. Around 2.5 million children live in homes that are damp. Around 1.5 million children live in households that cannot afford to heat their own home. And more than one in five adults have had to borrow in the last year to pay for just simple day-to-day needs. These are the findings of a major research project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, which is in turn largely financed by the government. In other words, this data is official. Now, Martin, how are we going to deal with the problem? Because it seems that there are more and more demands on benefits for the working people and also for the unemployed, and this is not going to go away, and nobody is dealing with it.
Well, what will happen if the economy does take a turn for the worse is that inevitably...
Well, it's going to increase. What I'm saying is, what can we do about it? And I'm going to ask you this as well in a minute, Kerry.
First of all, what you've got to do, if the economy does take a turn for the worse, you do have to spend more on benefits, and that actually protects the economy from falling down.
Where's this money going to come from?
Basically, the government can print money, and the deficit can be extended there's a crash. I'm not saying we should do it if there's not a crash.
It is printing money, in a way, isn't it, doing QE?
Well, of course it is. That's right. And so, in other words, government saying that they're going to cap this and cap that depends upon the performance of the economy. If the economy goes down the drain, then they're not going to cap anything. It's going to be a completely different situation.
Well, they're saying they are going to.
Well, yes, but I mean, you can say what you like, but it doesn't make any difference. If there was a downturn in the economy, the deficit would go up and spending on benefits would go up with it, inevitably. But that's not what... But leaving that aside, let's presume, for the sake of argument, that there isn't going to be a downturn in the economy. But, of course, that's a big assumption. You've got to actually change the nature of the way we used to have a fairly straightforward way of dealing with this. Conservative governments in the 1950s led the way in building council houses and providing affordable homes for people on low incomes. If you're going to have a competitive capitalist economy with inequality of income distribution, then the poorest third simply haven't got the resources to buy or rent at any reasonable price, which was well understood in previous decades, and therefore governments, including Conservative governments, made sure that housing was provided at a sensible price for those people. And the alternative, of course, is not to provide housing at a sensible price, which means you either put people into slums or on the street, or, and most likely, the housing benefit bill goes up.
Okay.
There's no way around it.
Kerry, I want to hear from you. What are you going to do about this exploding benefits bill?
Well, I would question, you know, I think the rhetoric about exploding benefits bill is taken straight
from
the Daily Express.
Yes, but also because a lot of working people are having to claim benefits as well now. It's going up and up.
Exactly. So, for a start, a lot of the time the figures you'll see, pensions, which are, you know, people are paid pensions because they've paid national insurance all their lives for the most part, that pensions would be included in that. We have an ageing population. It used to be people started claiming their pension at retirement age and weren't around by the time they were 70. Now people are living well into their 90s. So some of the increase is down to that. Some of it is down to the increase in rents, as we've just discussed. But at this week's Tory Party conference, David Cameron announced £7.5 billion worth of tax cuts. So we now have a government that thinks it can afford tax cuts, and tax cuts for the wealthy as well, and yet can't afford to keep benefits rising in line with inflation.
Okay, the Tories have had their say this week at their conference, but what is your policy? What are you going to do, Kerry?
Well, the things that we are looking at, I mean, very much committed to raising the minimum wage and also to supporting the living wage. That's something that Labour councillors have pushed George Ferguson. It took him a long time. It's taken 2 years to persuade him to agree.
Okay,
to,
but they've done that this week, haven't they? They've just raised it.
But that is partly about ensuring that employers pay people a decent wage and people don't have to look to the state to subsidise their income, which is obviously goes on the benefits bill. We're looking at things like a mansion tax introduced for people who've got homes worth more than £2 million. There aren't many. I don't think there are any of them in my constituency.
I know, an opposition person says we're looking at, that means you'd like to do it, but when you actually come to power, you won't.
Ed Balls announced it at conference. So when I say we're looking at it, I mean it's something that, yeah, we obviously don't get a chance to do unless we win the election. But yeah, it is party policy. We have the mansion tax, reintroduce the 50p rate of top tax for people earning more than, I think, 150,000 a year.
Okay, what
so
about,
it's trying about spreading the burden, making sure that the people who can most afford it actually have to pay it.
What about Martin's point there, which I thought was one of the most interesting I've heard, interesting ways of dealing with this, is we're doing all this QE at the moment. We're spending, apparently, this is not real money, this isn't cash, this is electronic money that's going into the stock exchange, into asset prices, to keep that all going. What about spending some of that through the benefit system? Would Labour consider that? Or, you know, is that part of your policy? Because it's all very well printing money, but at the moment it's all going into the casino banking system and it's not getting into the pockets of real people, which is what we need if we want the economy to start moving.
What we should be looking at is investment that will make the economy grow. So, if, for example, investment in new housing stock not only has the ultimate objective of reducing the housing bill by providing affordable social housing for people, but it also provides construction jobs. If you invest the money on creating apprenticeships for young people, and we've got this jobs guarantee that we've talked about that we are planning to introduce for young people, it's things like that that will get the economy growing, that will lift people out of poverty,
so
that will end up increasing economic growth.
Are you going to do anything
stop that vicious cycle?
Are you going to do anything about increasing benefits? Because for a lot of people are saying, look, this is actually makes sense. It helps to get the economy going. Rather than pumping money into the stock exchange, let's have it going to ordinary people, particularly the working poor.
Well, the working poor particularly, as I said, the minimum wage and the living wage are, I think, the best ways of ensuring that people lifted out of poverty. I think if you look at the figures for food banks, for example, it's something like 2/3 of the nearly a million people, so like 900,000 people have had recourse to food banks in the last year, and about 2/3 of them are people who are actually in work. It's not just people who are on benefits. So, yes, of course, so the focus should be on making work pay by things like the living wage. It should be about reducing the cost of living by tackling things like fuel bills and tackling too high rents. It should also be about, you know, providing that safety net, that support for people on benefits, ending the incredibly punitive sanctions where people have their money stopped for weeks at a time for no good reason.
But that's all going to make the benefit bill go higher, isn't it?
Yeah,
so are you happy with that?
But in terms of the social costs, the thing is, you know, the welfare state is there as a safety net for people who need it most. If I hear about people who have severe mental health problems, I've just come from doing a constituency surgery, people with severe mental health problems that a bus doesn't turn up, they're 20 minutes late for an appointment at the job centre, they get their benefits stopped for a fortnight or a month. That is clearly wrong. And, you know, who knows what the human cost is, what the social cost is of those people then being, you know, so stressed by the situation that they have to turn to mental health services or to other forms of support. It's a very false economy.
I think you're right. There's a lot of people out there who are actually suffering in silence. You know, the idea that someone comes along to you and says, well, there's no money for your food this week is a really, really difficult thing for anybody to have to deal with. But anyway, we were talking about housing a little bit there, and so was David Cameron in his keynote conference speech. So let's have a listen to him now.
We couldn't solve this housing crisis without some difficult decisions. The planning system was stuck in the mud, so we reformed it. And last year, nearly 250,000 houses were given planning permission. Young people needed massive deposits they just couldn't afford, so we brought in Help to Buy. Now, of course, there were those who criticised it, usually speaking from the comfort of the home that they'd bought some years ago. But let's see what actually happened. They said Help to Buy would just help people in London, but 94% of buyers live outside the capital. They said it would help people with houses already, but 4/5 are first-time buyers. They said it would cause a housing bubble, but as the Bank of England has said, it hasn't. So here is our renewed commitment to first-time buyers. If you're prepared to work and save, we will help you get a place of your own. At this conference, we've announced a landmark new policy. It's called Starter Homes. We're going to build 100,000 new homes, and they will be at least 20% cheaper than normal. But here's the crucial part. Buy-to-let landlords won't be able to snap them up. Wealthy foreigners won't be able to buy them. Just first-time buyers under the age of 40. Homes built for you, made for you. Our party, the Conservative Party, the party of home ownership, once again.
Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, it's a bit difficult for you to deal with that, isn't it? Because he's come up just this week, a few months before the next election, with a powerful new policy to build new homes, 20% cheaper than they would be on the open market.
Well, I'd like to see what the quality of these homes is going to be like. I remember the huge negative equity boom of the under John Major's government, where people were paying, they were getting 100% mortgages, and in some cases they were actually getting more than 100%, they were getting them cash back as well, to buy houses that were little more than rabbit hutches. And of course then at the moment the economic recession hit, they found that they were worth an awful lot less than they'd paid for. And yes, it's important that governments do what they can to help people get on the housing ladder, and there's been various schemes to do that. But the problems that I see in Bristol are amongst people who can't in their wildest dreams imagine getting on the housing ladder. They are people that need social housing, or they need decent quality affordable private rented housing, and we have a shortage of both of those in Bristol. That's where I'd like to see action to tackle it. And that what he's announced there is just a million miles removed from that.
Yes, but what are Labour going to do? 100,000 new homes he's promising. What? How many are Labour promising?
Well, Labour have promised that I think end figure is that we're hoping to get up to 1 million new homes, but by 2020, because obviously you can't start building the second, if we win the election on the 7th of May 2015, it takes a little while to get things in train, but by 2020 we should be building 200,000 a year.
Well, the trouble is, if you build too many homes, that's going to depress the price, isn't it? There won't be the demand there anymore, so homeowners won't like you. They may be in negative equity.
Well, no, this would be...
People who are buying now may end up in negative equity.
Well, there's always that problem with house prices, isn't there? Is that if you own a home, you want it to go up in value because, it's your prime asset. It's your main source of wealth. But then again, we are in a situation where people can't afford to get on the housing ladder. And when it comes to it, people want their children to be able to get on the housing ladder, their grandchildren get on the housing ladder. They want to be able to move home to somewhere that's not astronomically priced. I mean, it made me laugh, actually, when I heard David Cameron talking about wealthy foreigners snapping up these houses. These starter homes aren't the sort of things that wealthy foreigners are going for. You look at the London housing market, and particularly the Russians, who he's very pally with, It's their activity, it's their investment, and then buying up housing stock in London that has pushed the prices through the roof there.
And the Arabs. We heard something there which was quite interesting, which was that there is no bubble. The Bank of England have said it's official. There is no housing bubble.
Well, I just don't believe it, frankly. That's the sort of thing they would say.
Well, just explain why you think there is a housing bubble. Because I must admit, it does seem that more and more of our wealth seems to be going into housing.
In sensible countries like Germany, house prices don't move hardly at all. We've got used to this in Britain since the 1920s, when the Conservative governments of the era encouraged home ownership. But of course, encouraging home ownership through, for example, capital gains tax not being charged on capital gains on your first home and so forth, mortgage tax relief, creating subsidised housing for those who can afford to get onto the housing ladder, because lots of people, as Kerry pointed out, they're never going onto the housing ladder, so it's of no use to them. This is all completely opposite to free market policy. Free market policy is to let the market set the price. But of course the government intervenes to protect its own supporters. 7.5 billion in tax cuts for the wealthy, promised, I don't suppose it'll ever be delivered, at the same time as we've still got to tighten our belts because the deficit hasn't been reduced in one parliament, as George Osborne promised he would.
Okay, my definition of a housing bubble is rising prices when you've actually got an economy that's not actually in step with that. But also, the houses cost maybe somewhere in the region of about £50,000 each, you know, two, three bedrooms, semi-detached, to build it. That's in terms of materials and man hours to build it, or woman hours, if women are bricklaying or whatever. And actually, the price to buy it is far, far more. So there's an artificial inflated price. But anyway, let's go back to David Cameron's speech now, because he's saying that actually the Conservative Party is a trade union too.
Now, we know Labour's real problem on education. Every move they make, they have to take their cue from the unions. That is who they really represent, the unions. But I've got a bit of news for you. It's something we've never really said before. We in this party, we are a trade union too. And I tell you who we represent. This party is the union for hard-working parents, for the father who reads his children stories at night because he wants them to learn, the mother who works all the hours God sends to give her children the best start. This party is the trade union for children from the poorest estates and the most chaotic homes. This party is the union for the young woman who wants an apprenticeship, for the teenagers who want to make something of their lives. This is who we resent. These are the people that we are fighting for, and that is why on education we will not let Labour drag us back to square one. We're going to finish what we have begun.
Well, the Prime Minister got probably the biggest ovation of his speech for that. He's saying, actually, what the Conservative Party is, Kerry, is a trade union itself.
Well, it's just sort of silly political rhetoric, isn't it, really? This government is absolutely characterised by its hostility to proper trade unions that are set up to represent people's rights at work. You know, we've been hearing today about how they want to scrap the Human Rights Act as well. I don't really know what to say, because it's just so silly,
well,
isn't it?
Isn't it a brilliant piece of speech writing? I think certainly, as far as the polls go, it's gone down a lot better than Ed Miliband's speech the previous week, hasn't it?
Well, opinion polls are very flexible things in terms of, I know there was one poll that put the Tories 1 point ahead today, but Labour was 7 points ahead yesterday. I don't believe that anything has changed overnight to change that. So we need to look, that overall the position is that Labour are still ahead. And yeah, you know, the rhetoric is something, you know, he's obviously trying to send out a signal that they're on the side of what they would call, you know, he's sort of talking decent, hard-working parents and conjuring up this image of, you know, very nice, cosy families, and they're supporting them. You know, the problem is life isn't like that, and there are an awful lot of other people out there that need the help from the government as well, and you can't just sort of write off those people. Like I said, you know, I've been doing a surgery this afternoon. There are people who, you know, that my surgeries now, it is the exception rather than the rule to for people not to be in tears, and there are people that simply cannot cope anymore. The system is against them in every single way possible. They don't get the responses they need from the health service, from the benefits service, from the council, from the energy companies. Can't feed their families.
But Kerry,
they're living in substandard
accommodation. Kerry, I mean, that's quite touching.
He offers nothing for those
people. That's quite touching stuff. But what are you actually able to do for those people in tears?
Well, in terms of the individuals that come to me, what is frustrating and what is depressing is that when I get involved, the system bucks its ideas up a bit. And, you know, I appreciate that, you know, particularly at some of the, you know, the people at the DWP, for example, there's been job cuts and they are very under-resourced, and it's very difficult for them to keep on top of their workload.
This is the job centres, yeah.
Yeah, the job centres or the people that administer the benefits, or ATOS who do the disabilities. There's something like a 6-month delay In assessments, although actually I've been told that there are some cases that have been waiting since January 2013 to have their disability cases assessed.
So isn't that a good thing that they're not being assessed, because it means surely that they're continuing to get a decent amount of benefit until that assessment takes place?
No, because it's complicated, but after a year they drop off the system and they have to apply again, and it's really stressful for them, and they would be on the lower rate. And
So without any doctor looking at the person or whatever, they are assumed not to be needing the benefits. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there are various different stages of the process to go through, and it sort of gets a bit complicated as to where they are in the system. Basically, ATLS are having trouble recruiting the medical staff to carry out the assessments, and they're understaffed. And yeah, when people, particularly if they've got mental health problems, it's incredibly stressful for them to have to wait so long
this
for the
kind
assessment
of thing,
to be carried out.
Could and then push them over the often, edge.
Yeah, and quite often they're rejected, and then they succeed on appeal, but they have to wait another 6 months for appeal. And during that stage that you're rejected, you would go down to half the rate, so which is like the equivalent to job seekers' allowance. And, it is incredibly difficult. What I can do if people come to me is intervene, and, you know, the same with things like, say, the passport issue, which again was due to resources being cut, jobs being cut. I managed to get every single person who came to me in desperation because their passport had been delayed. There was one person I couldn't do it for, and that's because he contacted me Thursday night and was due to fly out Friday morning. The rest, we all managed to do it, but it shouldn't take an MP to get the system to work properly. The system should be well enough resourced that if people are told it will take 3 weeks to get a passport, they don't have to wait 3 months to get
a
passport.
Well, there's a couple of messages here. One is go and see your MP. Because sometimes if the bureaucrats are messing you about, the only way you can actually get them to behave is to go and talk to your MP.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, do keep an eye on your neighbours. Do keep an eye on those around you and your social circles, just to make sure people are all right, because we mustn't allow people to suffer in silence at the hands of these wicked bureaucrats.
And there is other support out there as well. You know, they can help the neighbours by going to referring them to the food banks, or there are other things, particularly as winter approaches. You know, that's when it will really get grim, when people, you know, can't afford to heat their homes. You know, we just have to pray we don't have a bad winter.
Martin, from the speech we just heard there, he's talking about, the Prime Minister's talking about the Conservative Party as a trade union. Interestingly enough, there's about 15 times more members of trade unions than there are of political parties in this country. And trade unions are generally much more democratic than political parties as well. So isn't that a good thing?
Well, I mean, the actual topic that he was addressing was the education system. And incidentally, I don't know if you picked up, he said, these are the people we resent rather than present. We don't have to go back over it.
No, just a second, because, yes, I've got that clip. So let's have a listen just to see if you're absolutely right.
Well, all right. What
you're saying.
For the young woman who wants an apprenticeship, for the teenagers who want to make something of their lives, this is who we resent.
Well, he says, this is who we resent. That's what he said. Not... That is who we represent.
He said, these are the people we resent, which I think is a bit of a Freudian slip. And of course, he's talking about the education system. He's saying what he means by the unions, he means teachers. Teachers, in fact, are a very substantial section of the community with a very great knowledge about what they do, who've been let down by lots of previous administrations, including this one, who don't seem to understand the kind of work they do or sympathise at all with the problems that they face. He's got similar problems with doctors, nurses and police officers. In actual fact, the idea that the Bullingdon boys running the country know more about education than frontline teachers is laughable. And in actual fact, most of the changes that have been carried out in the education system have been for the worse, without a shadow of a doubt. My family on both sides are teachers for two, three generations. There is a massive fall of morale in the teaching profession. Not because of the problems of dealing with the children. The children are the constant source of what makes people want to be teachers. What's the problem is the system, which has become completely ridiculous. I mean, the free school system now has become a complete farce, where virtually anybody can... There's one just opened, I believe, with 17 pupils in an area which has got masses of oversupply in the existing schools. And it's the money, taxpayers' money is being thrown down the drain of what are essentially prestige projects supported by Tory ministers. But of course, ultimately, what's happening is the education system is becoming a dog's breakfast.
But
your child will get a decent education.
This free school system, for example, the one with only 17 pupils, in a couple of years' time, it might do really well. It may have hundreds.
It may, or it may just go under having wasted millions, as many of them have. The point is, the idea of having choice and anybody being able to set up a school is all very well, but it's actually not the cheapest system. The cheap system is to use your use what resources you've got effectively, and of course the very idea of competition between schools is actually rather dubious. It's what happens in the private sector. Wellington competes with Winchester and so on, but in Bristol, for example, it makes a lot more sense for the resources that are here at the City Academy to be shared with other schools, and their resources to be shared with the City Academy. That's how it used to work.
Finally, if the Conservative Party is a trade union, who's it a trade union for?
I think it's the trade union for the hedge fund managers and the military-industrial complex, isn't it?
OK.
Schoolboys.
And for what was that, Kerry?
I was going to say in the public schoolboys.
Right.
Jobs for the boys, eh?
OK, onto another story. The IMF is saying banker bonus caps don't cut risks. They're rejecting bonus caps for bankers. This is Reuters on Wednesday. Capping bankers' bonuses will not cut risks in the financial system. The International Monetary Fund said on Wednesday, offering Britain moral support in its legal challenge to EU curbs on pay in the financial sector. In its latest global financial stability report, the IMF looks at pay in the banking sector, saying that excessive risk taken by lenders contributed to the global financial crisis. Reforms have sought to foster more prudent behaviour by banks, including how pay packets are structured. Measures include deferring parts of a bonus for several years and the ability to claw back awards if misconduct is uncovered. The European Union has gone further, capping banker bonuses at twice fixed salary. That has prompted some banks to bump up fixed pay by giving allowances to key staff. Martin, this IMF stuff, they're basically saying, look, the EU is not doing the right thing by trying to limit the bonuses for bankers, because this has got to be a free market. If a banker is successful, he's got to be able to be paid whatever he wants.
Well, the IMF have been shilling for the banking community for many years, so it's not exactly surprising that they've come out opposing EU policy. The fact is that the financial system is far more leveraged than it was in 2008. The derivatives market, the real source of the problem, is actually far bigger than it was even 4 years ago. And when the crash comes, and it will come, all of these people are going to be shown to be talking out of their backsides. I've just been reading a very interesting book by Harjun Chang, who's the Cambridge economist, about issues concerning the financial services sector. It's actually way too big, way out of control, and it should have been disciplined by being funded by the government as it was in 2008, and then dealt with like recalcitrant school children. But in actual fact, of course, the bailout has actually led to more arrogance than ever, and I'm afraid an incoming Labour government, and I think we are going to win because that's what the opinion polls say, may face a massive international financial crisis rooted in the City of London and Wall Street. So I hope they've got some plans for that if it happens.
Kerry, on this subject of banking bonuses and the EU, it looks like the EU is kind of on its own, with the City of London and the IMF, the bigger structures than the EU, both saying that bankers should have whatever they want. I mean, why not? Molly Scott-Cato, who's the new Green MEP for the South West, says she's had an opportunity to question Jonathan Hill, and he's a Eurosceptic and he's a former financial lobbyist and President Juncker's choice of European Finance Commissioner. Greens in the European Parliament have been highly critical of the planned appointment, but in his previous role in the City of London will make him reluctant to take a tough stance on financial regulation across Europe. So essentially, it looks like even the EU is going to have a finance commissioner who is very close to the City of London in the future, because they're just swapping around at the moment, aren't they, up at the EU. But anyway, to actually get back to the question, what are your thoughts about whether the EU is actually going to be able to limit these bankers' bonuses or not?
Well, if I can just say on his appointment, he wasn't approved after the first hearing because he couldn't demonstrate he understood enough about the financial system. So on the one hand, she's saying he's totally up to his neck in it and embedded and will be, you know, a lobbyist for the financial sector. But
he's a former financial lobbyist, she's saying.
Yeah, but apparently he doesn't understand very much about finance, so he didn't do very well at the hearing anyway. So there's question marks about his capability to do the job because of that. One of the things the IMF did say, which is also mentioned in the report you're referring to, was that if reward was linked to longer-term performance of the company, then that would actually be a way of reducing risk taking. So that's the key thing. And, you know, I actually used to work as a lawyer in this field, you know, in a former life. I've done lots of different jobs. But it's very clear that if a dealer can pull off a particular trade that makes huge overnight profits and their bonus is linked to that, they're going to take that risk. If it's something where their rewards are linked to the overall performance of the company, so they have to think about what's going to happen 6 months, 12 months, 2 years down the line, they're going to take a more sensible long-term approach. And that's what the IMF says. And I certainly think that's the way to go. I do think that capping bankers' bonuses is the right thing to do. And, yeah, I think it's a mixed picture in terms of the success it's had. But, yeah, I think it's important. But I also think if there's a way it can be linked to equity performance rather than just to overnight profit and loss, then that's important too.
OK, on to another story today, a local one. Annie Diwani, parents search for the truth. The parents of the murdered bride, Annie Diwani, tell the BBC today they're desperate for answers ahead of the trial of their son-in-law in South Africa. Now, this has been going on and on now, and it just seems like it's caught between two legal jurisdictions. Martin, what are your thoughts about this one?
Well, I mean, I don't know all the details of the individual case. I mean, I know there was a lot of question marks about whether he would be extradited and whether the South African police had got it right. But, I think the South African police have obviously been able to present a case to the British authorities that there was a case to answer, and that's why he's been extradited. I understand that the South African police were aware that the people that he was dealing with had a track record in South Africa of carrying out murders for money, and that's what led them to suspect in this case.
Kerry?
Yeah, I'm always very reluctant to comment on court cases, particularly when you haven't heard the actual evidence presented in court. I wouldn't want to prejudge that, but I do think that justice has to take its course. And, you know, for the sake of her family, the murdered woman's family, you know, to them it's a huge relief that the trial will go ahead. So I don't think I'd want to sort of say anything more other than that, you know, this has been dragging on a long time, and I'm pleased that it looks like it's a bit closer to a resolution now.
Okay. Also this week, the Snoopers Charter. Theresa May has vowed to implement measures to clamp down on extremist groups, and it's aimed at anyone dedicated to overthrowing democracy. But, of course, the question is, with clamping down on civil liberties like this, is Theresa May overthrowing democracy herself? The so-called Snoopers Charter would be implemented by a Tory government. Theresa May vowed as she tore into the Liberal Democrats for blocking plans to increase the monitoring of internet and email use. The Home Secretary this week set out new measures to clamp down on extremist groups in a speech which concentrated almost entirely on the threat from terrorism at home and abroad. She told the conference, "The lesson of history tells us when our enemies say they want to attack us, they mean it. We must not flinch, we must not shy away from our responsibility." Now, this is fighting talk, isn't it, Kerry, from the Home Secretary, and she is actually angling, possibly, to be the next Prime Minister.
Yes, I think, well, the next leader of the Tory Party. Yeah. I think she certainly has ambitions in that direction, as do a couple of her other Cabinet colleagues and the likes of Boris Johnson too. And this is, you know, she's obviously trying to send out the message that she's tough on extremism, tough on terrorism, which will go down very well with most people, it has to be said. The difficulty is always, how do you maintain that balance with civil liberties of having the power to intervene when it's needed? And we know that there is work to be done in preventing the spread of extremism via social media, via the internet, that there is a job of work to do for our security forces on that front. The problem is, how do you make sure there are sufficient checks and balances so that process isn't abused, either deliberately abused or by overzealous security forces? You know, I can't say too much at the moment, but I have a case at the moment where someone was detained under terrorism legislation at Bristol Airport, and this was somebody who was involved in left politics, not somebody who was suspected of involvement in Islamic terrorism. And yeah, the idea that somebody could be detained and questioned for 5 hours just because they've been on demonstrations is very, very worrying indeed. So we do need to make sure that we've got the checks and balances, and it's not just gung-ho. Some people will say to me that, you know, if you've got any suspicion about anybody, you should be able to lock them up and throw away the key. That is the sort of thing that is being said on Bristol streets at the moment. And, you know, when they talk about the schoolgirl that is perhaps on her way to Syria, there will be people that say, you know, she shouldn't be allowed back in the country and her parents should be thrown in jail. And we've got to be very robust in dealing with that sort of overreaction.
Well, I noticed that quite a lot of the national media didn't report that story, although it was all over the BBC earlier in the week. Some of the media decided not to report it at all because it wasn't actually backed with any evidence. Martin, we've had the former Shadow Home Secretary David Davis saying these are quite incredible powers to limit democratic rights, rights that people have had for 200 years in this country. It will have a real trouble both getting through the House of Commons and indeed real difficulty standing up in front of the court. Former Attorney General Dominic Grieve has said any restriction on freedom of expression of individuals outside the criminal law is something that has to be approached with very great caution. And Shami Chakrabarti, Director of Liberty, said the Home Secretary gave a good sermon about human rights and the rule of law in the Middle East whilst mocking the Court of Human Rights and proposing to ban non-violent speech in organisations. How do you promote liberal democratic values by promising state powers worthy of a caliphate?
Well, indeed. Now, the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, about 2 years ago on French television, said that when he was the Foreign Minister of France, he was approached, and this was before the Arab Spring, he was approached by British officials, and he stressed British, not US officials, and they said to him, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" Now, I put it to Theresa May that she knew that Britain was plotting an armed uprising in Syria before the Arab Spring, and that people in MI6 knew. Now, that means, according to her definition, that they are terrorists, just like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who ended up in Iraq running the Joint Services Group after being pointed out by a 14-year investigation by the Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police for running the Force Research Unit. He was fingered as a terrorist. Now, in other words, there are people inside the structure, inside MI6, who know exactly what's going on in Syria, and it's not about 15-year-old girls reading stuff on the internet. That happens every day about all sorts of things. There is, in fact, large chunks of evidence which suggest that elements within the British state have been working with Islamic extremists since the 1980s, Operation Cyclone. Now, if Theresa wants to lock me up for saying that, she can do so. But I'll happily go to court and we'll talk about the evidence for British government involvement in Islamist terrorism going back decades.
Now, let's get back to this story about that Kerry brought up there about the radicalised, inverted commas, Bristol teenage girl, so-called heading for Syria, saying the police. Well, let's also remember this is the same police press office that told newspapers around the world that Christopher Jeffries was the prime suspect in the murder case that happened, and he was hounded really appallingly for it. Anyway, the actual story is in the Post, a 15-year-old girl from Bristol has gone missing, and may, a very important underlined word there, may be trying to get to Syria. This blew up on exactly the same day, of course, as this Theresa May speech, and I was listening to Five Live on the day. There was some live coverage from around her parents' home, and they were saying that the parents were tearing their hair out because the police had given them absolutely no evidence of the Syria connection at all. Anyway, Kerry, what do you make of attempts to stop this kind of thing? Because clearly, people are, some of them anyway, are going to the Middle East and getting involved, whether it's on the side of the Israeli forces or on the side of radical Islamic forces or elsewhere. I mean, what do you think should be done about that?
Well, the last Labour government, I think it was in the wake of the July the 7th bombings, which took place just after I was elected to Parliament in 2005, they introduced this PREVENT programme, which was designed to work within communities to combat this radicalisation. And the government has cut funding for that massively. It's a shadow of its former self. And it was doing some very, very good work.
Well, what they've said
Bristol.
Is that it wasn't working.
Well, they it's their, that's how they operate, isn't it? They denigrate anything that the public sector is doing as an excuse to cut the funding. There was evidence that it was working pretty well, and I think it's now needed more than ever. I mean, this is about community outreach and engagement. I think it's, you know, people like Councillor Hibak Jama, who's a young Somali woman who represents Lawrence Hill, has been very involved in talking to the family, and I think it's really important that we have role models like her playing that part. But it's... There is a huge amount of work that needs to be done. I think there are issues as well. You know, I was talking to someone earlier today about Anjum Chowdhury, who is constantly put up on Newsnight as the spokesperson for the Muslim community. He's got very strong, radical, extremist views. I think he's under arrest at the moment. That sort of thing isn't helpful either if it's constantly presented as radical Islam against, you know, the voice of reason.
I totally agree. I mean, I've made a lot of criticism of this thing called the Quilliam Foundation, which, in fact, a former head of the English Defence League joined as a so-called spokesman for that, unbelievably. And a lot of much more sensible, moderate, much more representative Muslim organisations, like, for example, MPAC in London, the Muslim Public Affairs Committee, you never see them on the TV at all. Which brings us on to
criticisms of the Muslim Council of Britain, but you don't even see them anymore. There's a handful of these
which are being cherry-picked by the press. Yeah. Anyway, let's go on to a related story, and this one is to do with a chap called Udo Ulf Kotti. Now, he's a German journalist. He worked in national newspapers in Germany, and he's just published a book called Bought Journalism, and it's a book on the CIA buying journalists like him, and he's confessing. He's saying, yes, they paid me. Here's one of his little quotes. He's a spy in every newsroom. So let's have a listen to him now.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years, and I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. I have been a non-official cover. It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you're not only a journalist but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too.
So he's basically saying that if it ever looks like it might be exposed that he's been being paid by intelligence services to write stories or spin them in a particular direction or plant them even in the news, in the national news, that all the authorities will say, oh, it's nothing to do with us.
Well, yes, I mean, we've known about this sort of thing for ages. And, of course, what's actually happening is that this is coordinated with geopolitical strategy. And I'll come back to what I said earlier. Muazzam Begg has just been released in Birmingham. He, of course, was released because he was able to show that he'd been cooperating with MI5 when he was going out to Syria. And, of course, what he was probably doing is making links with radical groups in Syria so that MI6 could use them to overthrow Assad. I mean, let's think about where we were this time last year. We were being told that Assad was the worst thing ever, we were going to have to go to war to overthrow him, and in actual fact there's mountains of evidence to suggest that British Special Forces were training Islamist extremists in Jordan and Turkey. The Turkish government certainly was, they're part of NATO. The Saudis were training them, they're our allies. So who is really arming and training the extremists in Syria? It's actually our own Special Forces and intelligence services, and if we're really serious about putting a stop to it, we're going to have to put some of those people in prison.
Kerry, what about this wider issue of journalists being bought in the national press? And we're not necessarily saying it's happening as much here in Britain, but this is one guy that's written a book about it, definitely happening in Germany, and he's had quite a lot of publicity over there, very little here though.
Yeah, I have to say that I have no idea whether it's a widespread practice, the extent to which it's happening. The concern I have about the press in this country at the moment, and it's something you will see with local newspapers like the Bristol Post, they are so short on resources, there have been so many staff cuts, that they will just regurgitate press releases from companies, and particularly their websites. You look at the Daily Mail website and it's just one, you know, bit of PR guff after another, which means there's no questioning, there's no investigation. The role of the investigative journalist is, you know, a shadow of what it used to be. And I think that is quite worrying in terms of the information we're being fed, not being challenged.
Well, we had financial journalist Ian Fraser on this programme probably 6 or 8 months ago, saying he's really worried because almost all of the financial journalists are far, far too close to the city, for example.
I think that may well be the case.
Well, the journalist that people ought to be aware of is Seymour Hersh, who won the Pulitzer Prize in the US. He exposed the My Lai massacre back in the 70s. He also wrote a very interesting article.
What was this My Lai massacre?
The My Lai massacre was when US Marines killed a whole village worth of Vietnamese, because that was the sort of thing they were up to at the time, and he exposed it. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for that. And he's got a reputation in the US for never getting anything wrong, ever. And he's put a big question mark over the so-called assassination of bin Laden. He says basically that's a load of rubbish. It's just an invented story. And he also pointed out that the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta last year was carried out by the rebels with support from the Turks and the Saudis and probably with the knowledge of MI6. That's terrorism. Who in MI6 knew what? What are we going to do about it?
OK. Hundreds of GP practices are threatened with closure as doctors quit in their droves. Charlie Cooper in The Independent yesterday. More than 500 GP practices in England could be forced to close within a year as family doctors leave the profession, the Royal College of General Practitioners has warned. Now, they actually use the term themselves, in their droves. GPs have been caught in a deepening workforce crisis, the Royal College of GPs says, with too few trainee doctors choosing to go into general practice and too many senior GPs taking early retirement, moving abroad or starting completely different careers. They've identified 543 practices where either all or most of the working doctors are over the age of 60. The average age for a GP to retire is 59, and with nearly 1 in 10 GP posts already unfilled, they predict that a new wave of retirements will mean many of these practices will be unable to replace staff and will have to close, Kerry.
It's absolutely the case. We had the St Martin's surgery in Knowle that was threatened with closure over the summer. Two of the GPs, I think, had taken early retirement, and the other two just decided that they couldn't function with they couldn't keep the practice going. And I met with the Avon Medical Committee earlier this week, a bunch of GPs from across the Avon area who were telling me exactly the same thing. People now, you know, medical students don't want to go into general practice because they will be so overworked. The David Cameron announced at Tory conference this week that people would be able to get appointments 7 days a week. Well, that's fine if they actually give GP surgeries the financial resources to be able to take on extra staff to do that. But it's a real problem within the Bristol area, and Bristol isn't as difficult to recruit to as many other places. It's seen as quite an attractive place to live. So if it's a problem here, it's a far bigger problem in some other parts of the country.
Martin, the Department of Health are saying, we know GPs are under pressure, which is why we're increasing trainees so that GP numbers continue to grow faster than the population, and we'll train 10,000 more primary and community health and care staff by 2020, including 5,000 more GPs. So it sounds like at least the Department of Health are on the case.
Well, I think there's a bit of a bidding war going on between the main parties now about being the most friendly to the NHS, and that's good because it's one of the things that the people care about. Let's hope the next election is about the NHS and that the Tories lose it.
How hackable is your car? Consult this handy chart. This is one I've found at Wired.com. All the cars' ratings were based on three factors. The first was the size of their wireless attack surface. Features like Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, cellular network connections, keyless entry systems, and even radio-readable tyre pressure monitoring systems. But anyway, there are lots of different aspects that go into how, if you can get into a car's computer using a smartphone or a wireless system that the car is near, and also then whether that will lead you in to the car's key components, things like the braking system, the steering system, the accelerator. And here's what they've done is a pretty reasonable chart. Actually, Audi's come very, very high up the list, which we haven't heard up till now, and the Toyotas as well, quite a lot of them. So I would suggest I'll put a link on the show programme to this so you can go and check to see if your car is, how easy that is to hack. But anyway, what are your thoughts, Kerry? Because my thoughts reading this are, I want to make sure I buy a nice old-fashioned second-hand car that doesn't have too many computers and gadgets on it, so someone can't sit in the back seat and steer my car for me.
I was just saying, I was looking at the list of all these features that these cars have got, and my car certainly hasn't got anything of the sort. It's got a radio that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, and it does have heated seats. This all sounds incredibly high tech, and I have to say I don't understand. It's talking about cyber physical features on cars.
Well, the main two sides of it are, first of all, whether you can actually get into the car's computer remotely, whether that being through a wireless network, a Bluetooth, that sort of thing. Yeah. And the second one is whether that computer is controlling your wheels, your steering, this kind of thing. And certainly, I mean, there's quite a few cars now, especially designed for elderly people or whatever, which will park themselves and will steer the wheels. So the problem is, and there's quite a lot of demonstration videos now on YouTube of people who are just basically remotely hacking cars and steering them around, Martin.
Well, yes, it's a problem, isn't it? I mean, what's the name of that journalist in the LA?
Michael Hastings, in July last year.
He was a journalist investigating the CIA and various...
He was driving a top-of-the-range Mercedes, wasn't he?
Yes, and he went to his girlfriend and said, there's something the matter with my car, can I borrow yours? And she said, no, I'm afraid it's in the Menders being fixed. So he carried on using his car, and the suspicion is that the car was hacked by somebody, and he was crashed into a tree in a 30-mile-an-hour zone area. Now, in other words, that shows the possibilities. I'll say no more than that. And, of course, planes, which are run on computers, they can be hacked and flown in different directions. And the Global Hawk technology has existed since 1972, when a plane was flown across the Pacific from the US to Australia.
Okay, so with that story, I'll definitely put some links on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk for the car nerds around to check out that, see how your car's doing. Also, watch some of these pretty shocking videos of people remotely controlling people's cars as they're doing quite high speeds. Co-op banks presiding over the growing breed of state schools in England. Now, we did have some stories earlier on about education, but this is another one. Co-op banks may be beset by scandals, but the movement also presides over a fast-expanding group of schools. Richard Garner finds out how one of the secondary schools puts the value-driven, faith-neutral philosophy into practice. This is a cooperative bank is investing in our schools, Martin.
Well, it's not the cooperative bank. I think you'll find it's the cooperative movement. So these are cooperative schools, but they are not necessarily run by the bank.
Okay. So they're using the bank just to say, well, hang on, the banks aren't doing very well, but these co-ops are doing
well.
Yes,
I mean, Co-ops UK have encouraged people to set up cooperative schools. And I suppose that's what you have to... If the system is being fragmented and ruined, I would say, as I said earlier, then the activists and others in the community have to step forward. And having a cooperative school, they work particularly well in rural areas, and, you know, the model seems to be functioning very well out there, and people are using it.
Kerry, in 2008, the co-op had about 100 schools. In fact, it now has 767 schools, 718 foundation trust schools and 44 academies, 5 business and enterprise colleges.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is quite topical because Brislington Enterprise College actually went down the co-op trust route. The head teacher didn't want to go down the academy route, but now it's on course to become an academy run by Oasis. And this only came to my attention in the last week or two. So, you know, I'm trying to find out what's happened, what went wrong with the co-op trust model. But it was certainly seen as quite an ethical way of running a school. And, you know, I think cooperatives are great models for running things like, you know, housing for, obviously, social enterprises. We've got a really good credit union, which is run on cooperative lines in Bristol. So, you know, I don't see... I think there is a problem, as Martin said, about the fragmentation of the school system. And one of the things Labour said that it would introduce if it got into government would be a council-based, I think it's Commissioner for School Standards, that would actually have authority over the schools in the area, regardless of what sort of model they're run by.
OK, Kerry, I have to stop you there. It's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. That was Bristol East MP, Labour MP, Kerry McCarthy. After the news... we go in depth to look at what the Conservative Home Secretary Theresa May didn't mention in her conference speech.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the father of a British man being held hostage by Islamic State has made an appeal from his hospital bed for the militants to free him. Barry Weir reports.
Paul Cantley, who's 81, has recently had a throat operation and recorded this statement in hospital.
I can think of no greater joy than seeing him again. Released.
John Cantley was working as a photojournalist in northern Syria when he was taken in 2012. He's recently appeared in IS videos online, which his dad says was a relief at first, but it quickly turned into a feeling of despair and helplessness. Mr. Cantley says he's trying to communicate with IS to deliver an important message, but has had no response.
Two Burmese men have been paraded on the beach where two British backpackers were found dead. Thai police say the suspects have confessed. David Miller and Hannah Witheridge were attacked last month. A teenager's been jailed for a minimum of 14 years after strangling his pregnant girlfriend with a scarf. 18-year-old Aston Robinson killed Kayleanne Palmer, who also lost her unborn child in Cheltenham in April. Thousands of drinkers in England and Wales who have 3 pints a day or half a bottle of wine are to be offered a new pill on the NHS to cut their consumption. It'll only be prescribed alongside counselling, though, and will cost the health service £3 a tablet. We asked these people what they think about the idea.
It saves all the monetary funds of getting on dry now clinics.
I don't think it's the best answer. It gives people an excuse to just carry on with what they're doing and just take a pill when they need it.
I think we've got a cure for everything at times, and it can just be overstepped.